episode 342 of Cinematary. I'm your host, Zach Dennis, and I'm here with
Reed Ramsey,
Seth Troyer,
and Jessica Carr.
And in today's episode, we'll be talking about movies that we saw this week in part one. And in part two, we will be finishing up our Tilda Swinton series with 2011's We Need to Talk About Kevin, which, let me just tell you, is a nice feel-good movie to wrap up the series with. It is not. It's...
I smile a lot.
Real quickly, I want to direct y'all to cinematary.com. We got some new reviews. We have Can't Get You Out of My Head, An Emotional History of the Modern World by Adam Curtis. I don't know what that means, to be honest. I'll just show my ignorance on that one. But it's a good review. Astor Gilbert wrote it for us. We also have To All the Boys, Always and Forever, and Earwig and the Witch. So we're covering all the 2021 releases over here on Cinematary. So check it out. But before we get to part two, let's talk a little bit about movies that we saw this week. And Reed, I'm going to kick it off with you.
Yeah, no problem. The movie I wanted to talk about for a minute was the documentary called Boys State. It played at Sundance last year, and I remember hearing about it for quite a while. It's about maybe a lot of our listeners have heard, there's these conventions, is the best way to describe it, of boys, and they also have girls state, that go to state capitals and a lot of states for a week every year, every summer. They're high school students, and they spend that week trying to basically build their own government, elect officials, and run different campaigns. I didn't really know what to expect. I thought it would be, at the very least, kind of like a funny documentary, watching basically 17-year-old boys that are all just jacked up on other energy from 17-year-old boys discuss political issues, and that really is what it is. But we get some interesting characters. The documentary focuses on just like four of the boys. One of them, his name was Steven Garza. He's kind of the one progressive. I'm sorry, this takes place in Texas, so he's kind of the one progressive minded
Damn,
person.
Texas getting dragged.
Hey, I love Texas. I'm just saying. Well, and that actually gets to kind of one of the interesting points, but he's very progressive and outward about it there. And that's like kind of the personality he takes on. He's also very quiet, but he decides he wants to run in like the ultimate race for governor, even though he's one of the, kind of the more quiet, soft-spoken guys. And it's basically about him running for governor against the opposing party. And the most interesting thing to me is that the parties are randomly assigned. So you have like 600 of these high schoolers who are just randomly thrown together and told to come up with like a party ideology that's somewhat coherent. And the one in Texas is infamous because the year before, the whole Boys State actually voted to secede from the union as one of their major measures, which is discussed a lot in the documentary because a lot of these boys don't want that to happen. They don't want to secede, and it's a major issue. But it focuses on Steven and then also a few other characters that are interesting. And one of my favorite character in the movie is Robert McDougall. He's kind of like he honestly comes across kind of fratty. But he's really charismatic, and he has no real ideology that he puts out there, but he decides he's running for governor against Steven within their party. And it's interesting because we get all these talking head moments of him trying to explain why he chose something. Like when before we even figure out what his real beliefs are, he's talking in front of the whole crowd of boys, telling them about how abortion is murder, and that's what he believes, and that's what he's running on. And then it cuts to him talking to the camera and kind of explaining that he's actually pro-life, but he figured lying was the best way to get the votes of the people. And he even has this kind of like aha moment, like, huh, I guess this is why politicians do this. It makes sense. I actually have them behind me now. And it's really fascinating. I think the documentary is definitely it's definitely not comprehensive in terms of looking at politics, as it can't really be because it's only a week. But it is definitely an interesting case study. And what I found maybe most disturbing is watching all these 17-year-olds basically that have a strong belief in government and politics and they want to go into the field, watching them all basically become disillusioned with how their own beliefs could fit in and just kind of like back put that on the back burner and put forth instead this whole idea of winning and competition and like beating the other side. And it's pretty interesting. I would definitely recommend it.
Yeah, it's one that's kind of intrigued me because I know it was one of those movies. Well, I guess we're in an awards cycle or whatever now. That's been floated around as one of the better docs from last year. But I was kind of curious, you know, where like what it was kind of investigating in terms of like the politics of it. And so that's kind of interesting that it kind of floats around on that. Because I mean, I was born in Texas. I'm familiar with Texas. I know kind of how that, how that kind of leans. And so it seemed like, at least not from the outside, cause I've not watched this yet, that it at least investigates that to a degree. I mean, is that fair?
Yeah, no, it definitely does. And it's interesting to watch what they do agree on and then what the more outspoken ones are willing to compromise on in order to like win the support of the majority. So it even digs into like Stevens going around asking people about progressive policies and a lot of them agree with it. But at the end of the day, they're most passionate about abortion and gun rights. And that's what both parties, that's what their major policies are focused on, which is interesting when it comes down to the main race anyways, that their party agendas actually align pretty similarly.
Cool. Well, it's, I believe, Boy State is on Amazon or is Apple?
Apple TV.
Apple. Another Apple movie that's, do you have Apple?
Yeah, I got a new phone, so now I have Apple, which has been nice. You get a free year of it if you get a new Apple product. Now this is an ad.
Those are the only people who have Apple.
Yeah, that is so true.
Those are the only people who have Apple, because who's like paying money for that?
I know. Now I would say you should do the free trial and watch Ted Lasso. It is as good as everyone says.
Really? I really want to watch it, but I also don't. Okay, I might do that.
Yeah.
We completely got on a whole different tangent. Let me just end this tangent on this note. If you have Apple, Reed, you should watch Wolfwalkers, which is wonderful.
I need to. It's next on my list.
All right. Since you're one of like maybe 8 people in America that has Apple TV and like a full. Cool. Jessica, I'll send it over to you.
Yeah. So I was super excited to watch the sequel of Coming to America, which is Coming the Number 2 America. Which, like, whenever I was, like, explaining to people that I watched this, I was like, how do they know that I watched the sequel if I don't say that it has the number 2 in it? And they did that on purpose. That's, like, good marketing right there. But anyways, it was directed by Craig Brewer, who you might know from directing Hustle and Flow. And most recently, he directed Dolomite Is My Name, which also starred Eddie Murphy, and it was also really good.
He's from Memphis.
Really? I did not know that. Well, there you go. But anyways,
local connection.
Yeah, so this movie follows Prince Akeem, and it shows him, like, years later, like, after he gets married, and he assumes, like, his role as Prince of Zamunda, and his father is dying, and so he is going to have to become the King of Zamunda, but the problem is that he is trying to find an heir, and he has 3 daughters, and in Zamunda, women are not allowed to take the throne at all. And they're also not allowed to have businesses, and they actually don't have rights at all, surprisingly. Like, who knew that you know, in the movie where women are like bathers that serve you, like they also couldn't have a business. That's crazy. But yeah, so he finds out that he has a son who is living in Queens. And so he's like, okay, so my plan is I'm going to get my son, because Wesley Snipes plays this like general who is trying to stage a coup against Prince Akeem, but he is trying to like have the families, what's it called? Not combine, but like basically to have an arranged marriage so that both of their families like have an alliance together instead of fighting each other. And so he has a daughter and he's like, well, if you have a son, like they can get married. But Prince Akeem doesn't tell his wife this. He just goes to Queens, finds his son, just tells, like, he finds a son who he's never met before and is like, hey, like, you're a prince. And I want you to come with me to Zamunda, this like magical place where you can rule and be prince. And whenever we see Prince Akeem's son, Lavelle, he is in his, I think he's in his late 20s, and he is trying to get a job and he can't, so he is forced to like scalp tickets. And in this like, in this very clever scene, he is like at a job interview and the guy is like asking him, well, like, what experience do you have and why do you have this gap in your resume? And it's like very obvious that this like rich white guy is like looking down on him because he didn't wear like a suit. Like, he decided to just kind of like dress, still dress like kind of professionally, but to still dress like himself. And it was like very obvious that he was like kind of like stereotyping him, and he was like, well, is your dad in the picture, and like saying things like that. And it's like pretty obvious that Lavelle is like having a hard time making ends meet, and he like lives with his mom in like a very small apartment, and he had to drop out of college to help her pay for rent. And like obviously he has had a very hard time, and then out of nowhere his long lost father like shows up and says like, actually, you're royalty, and I will take you to a place where they treat you like royalty. And it's kind of like turns into like a Princess Diaries situation where he's like turned into like, he's like has a person who gives him a makeover, and he brings it, he's like, I have to bring my mom with me, and brings her over there, and it becomes this like whole thing. But the movie has I think like the thing that kind of where it loses its magic is that in the first Coming to America, we spend a lot of time with Eddie Murphy in Queens, and we're seeing him realize that, you know, an African American in Queens like does not have, they are not treated the same as like people in Zamunda, and kind of like him realizing his privilege, the privilege that he has is not the same. And I think that there's like a charm to that because he is forced to like he works at a fast food restaurant and is kind of like working his way up, and then he falls in love, and his whole thing is that he wants to like change the system, like change what is happening in Zamunda by finding a woman that he loves instead of going through with an arranged marriage. And but I think the second one is good too, because he realizes that he is trying to force his like newfound son into the same system. Like, he wants to have an arranged marriage so that he can like just form this alliance that is like pretty unnecessary. He's just doing it out of fear because he doesn't want like a war to break out with this guy, when he has an extremely capable and very smart eldest daughter who has been raised for this position, but because of her gender, like, she's not allowed to take the throne. And obviously, like, beat for beat, you kind of know what's going to happen. Like he is going to figure out, like, oh, you know, I didn't make any kind of systematic change, and so I am going to, like, make a difference now by electing someone who does make systematic change. And to me, like, that's a really smart thing. Like, that's a really smart message for a sequel to have. Like, if you watch literally any other sequel, like, they probably aren't saying something that is that, like, compelling and good. And so, like, that message on top of, like, the comedy, like, it's very funny, and Eddie Murphy plays, like, multiple roles, like he did in the first one, and so does Arsenio Hall, and just, like, classic characters that you love, like the guys in the barbershop who are just, like, just, like, shitting on everybody all the time and, like, cracking jokes, like, they're there. And, like, the other thing that I really, really loved about this movie is that the costuming is so beautiful. And it reminded me a lot of Black Panther because it shows a lot of, like, what black royalty looks like. And just, like, the costuming and all of the jewelry and all of the gowns. It's just, like, so extravagant and so beautiful, and like to think of like somebody putting all of those things together, it reminds me a lot of Crazy Rich Asians, where it's like you're used to seeing these groups of marginalized people like shown extremely poor and not able to like afford anything and struggling, but like in this movie you can see them thriving, and they're very strong and very resilient, and also just like look so elegant and so poised. It's really, really awesome. Like, I really enjoyed watching it. I could see how some people would be like, wow, it's like so predictable and it's just full of all the things that you loved in the first one but not as good. Like, I think that that is like a very pessimistic way to look at it. I think if I'm like, I loved the first one so much because I just kept thinking about the scene where, like, his wife that he was supposed to marry, he was like, well, what kind of movies do you like? And she's like, whatever movies you like. He's like, well, what kind of food do you like? And she's like, whatever food that you like. And it was just, like, so funny. I think the writing is so good, and, like, I think about all of the things in the first one, like, so often that I'm happy that the second one exists, if only to remind me of, like, how amazing the first one was.
I don't know. I think the best part of the first one is when Arsenio Hall and Eddie Murphy go on the cavalcade of dates, and they keep having the people go through the booth. Do they have that part in Coming to America, too?
Yeah, they do. No, they do a replay of that, and like, spoiler alert, like the twins that show up that are beatboxing, like they're also in the second one. Like the actual like women that also played the twins are also in it. They pretty much, what was crazy is that they pretty much got everybody back. Like that, the first one was made in 1988, and all of these people were like, yeah, we want to be in the second one. And, like, there was not a single person, like, you know, in some sequels, you're like, really, they recast that person, they look nothing like the first person, but, like, all of these people were the same. So, see,
I love, the first Coming to America is probably, to me, like, one of the funniest studio comedies the last, you know, 40 years or so. It's so good. So I'm a little hesitant on this because at least, for, you know, and again, you talked about this, but one of the things I heard is that it is it's like very callback filled. Like it's just a lot of references and callbacks to the first film. And I feel like that's kind of a tough line to kind of toe because you definitely want some of that because that's part of the reason why you're bringing the movie back in the first place. But I mean, I guess, do you feel like it establishes itself enough to be like its own movie? Because I mean, the first one is so recognized in its own way.
Yeah, I think that it definitely does because the whole plot line with the eldest daughter and her wanting to enact change, I think is enough for it to be its own movie. Like, I think that it is saying something else than what the first one was saying.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean,
I thought you were talking about Jungle 2 Jungle with Tim Allen, and I was so perplexed for a second.
No.
It's like, it also has a 2 in the middle, but it's like it's like horrendous. I was like, whoa, I didn't know Eddie Murphy was in that.
Can do a marathon of movies with a two in the middle. Too Fast, Too Furious, Coming to America.
That's coming up next as our new series on Cinematary, the two series. All right, well, I'll get to it at some point. I don't know. I'm just very skeptical. I love the first Coming to America, and so this one I was like, eh.
If you just need one reason to watch it, it's Wesley Snipes, because I don't know who his agent is, but they are doing a great job with his comedic roles that he's been doing. Like, he plays this, like, director in Dolomite. He plays this director who is, like, so fussy and so full of himself, but he's kind of like a big baby. And in this one, he plays a general who is the same. Like, he's, like, very, like, trying to be tough, but he is, like, a big baby, and it's awesome.
So pretty much...
Oh, my God. I didn't even know he was in this, and it makes me want to watch it literally so much more.
So pretty much you just want Wesley Snipes to be a big baby.
Well, it's like his, it's like he does such a good job of like, I don't know how to explain it. It's like he plays these, like, they're supposed to be larger than life type of dudes, like a general or like a director. They're the head honcho, but they're like, so you're just like, this guy is like so full of himself and he does not know anything. Like, it's all a show. But like the way, like, Wesley Snipes does such a good job of playing that character. I don't know. It's like so funny when he does it, because you're like, oh, this guy does not know what he's doing.
Well, Coming to America, or Coming to, there you go, number two, America, is going to be, it's on Amazon Prime. So be sure to watch it. Don't watch it. If you're listening to this episode this weekend, don't watch it. But watch it next week, because, yeah. I don't know if you're keeping up with Amazon stuff. We don't have to get into that. That's not this kind of podcast. cool. Seth, you had a couple movies you wanted to talk about.
Yeah. I'll start with the most important ones. Obviously, Legend of Bigfoot. It's actually like a two-parter. There's like two documentaries. They're from the 70s. I don't know who directed them, but it kind of doesn't matter. It's like, basically, this guy named Ivan Marks, who's like now he's known as like one of the biggest like tall tale like Bigfoot. He's just faking Bigfoot. He like has a ape suit and everything, and he's like filming it in these documentaries. And he's just lying to you the whole time, but it's very entertaining and very like atmospheric. It's just like these long winded, it's like hanging out with your uncle or something. And he's just like you just came in for like a beer, and then all of a sudden you're like there for hours, and he's showing you like all this, like there's like points where he's just like showing you like chipmunks for like 5 straight minutes, just like chipmunks that he filmed with his camera. And then like the next scene is like, and then I found Bigfoot again, that guy found me again, and you know, there he is. And he's just like clearly this awful like ape suit with like a pointy head. I'm always really confused about why they have pointy heads, the Yetis and the Bigfoots, but this one definitely does. There's also these, like,
I don't know the science of the Bigfoot, so I couldn't speak to
that. Yeah, he didn't get into it. But he does get into like why we don't find Bigfoot bodies, which is because they like pick up their dead and walk them for hundreds of miles to the glaciers, where they throw them in and the glaciers like move and shred up the bodies. Case solved. There's Legend of Bigfoot, and then there's Shadow Bigfoot, which is the follow-up, which is, it seems like it's getting a little sloppy at that point. It's not as good, but it's got this great soundtrack that is just all, I forget the guy's name, but it's like all this 70s rock of just like, and all the songs are about Bigfoot, and it's extraordinary.
Is he like trying to he's just educating you on Bigfoot, or is he like trying to find Bigfoot, or what's
he's just... always looking for him and finding him, no problem.
Because that seems to be the whole like thing with Bigfoot, is you can't find him. So
no, he has no trouble. He even there's one point where he's like clearly like holding the camera somehow, and then he shoots Bigfoot with a shotgun, and Bigfoot like falls over and gets back up. Bigfoot's bulletproof. I think
that's just a murder.
But he can hold the camera so still while he's shooting Bigfoot with his shotgun.
I don't have any follow up on that. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I don't have any speculation at all. So those are great. Those are all on YouTube. Wonderful crackling resolution. And then the other one I'll just talk about real quick is Extro. I've never seen anything that like replicates like the nightmares that I had as a child. I think it's from the 80s. It's like a British movie, and it's like hardly any budget, but they make it go so far. Like the director just admitted that it's like they just knew they had to make like an alien movie, and he just like whatever they thought of, like, if can we get a panther in here? Let's get a panther down here for some reason. The alien has a panther. Let's have this kid have magical powers out of nowhere. Let's have a woman give birth to a man, like a fully grown man at one point. I say all that, but really it's a touching story of a dad trying to reconnect with his son.
I assume so, yeah.
Yeah, so that's Extra. It blew my mind. That's all I'll say about it.
All right, well, I think, I'll be honest, I think the takeaway from both these movies is I think a lot of people have a lot of questions about your watching habits, Seth. Because I don't know where you found these. It's fascination, to be honest. Like,
I have never heard of either of these movies.
You gotta try YouTube, man. It's free. You should try it.
Okay.
You gotta try YouTube, y'all.
Neither had I.
Yes. It's Y-O-U, tube.
I feel like it's that skit from I Think You Should Leave where he makes up the bozo dubbed, and they're just like, what? It only has like 3 views, and he's like, have you seen it? It's hilarious. Like, I feel like Seth made these movies.
God, when is the second season of that going to come out, for the love of God? I've been waiting.
I love that so much.
The hot dog one is my favorite. looking for the guy who did this.
The hot dog. Let me just make a hyperbolic statement. The hot dog sketch, and I Think You Should Leave, perfectly personifies the 4 years of the Trump administration in the United States and maybe American history. So, if that's not a ringing endorsement, you know where you can find that, Seth. I'm gonna let you take it from here. It's YouTube.
Oh yeah, it's YouTube. It's all on there.
It's all on there.
For you.
It is. Oh, man. And, well, I got to say that this guy on Letterboxd helps me for sure. PD187. That's his name. I highly recommend it.
Shout out to PD187.
He doesn't follow me back. That's fine. It's just unrequited.
What the hell, PD?
It's fine.
If you're hearing this,
he is very cool.
Yeah, if you're hearing this, PD, you should become a patron, PD, if you're listening.
Well, it's not.
He better follow you back for this shout out.
Oh, no. See, now I'm never going to get him to accept me.
I'm gonna leave him some bad comments.
Or just a bunch of like, what is Seth Troyer not good enough to be a follow on Letterboxd? All right, well, we'll do that. That'll be our next adventure. We'll just spam PD187's Letterboxd account until he follows Seth. All right, cool. Well, let's take a quick break, because I think everybody needs it. And we'll be back talking about Kevin after this. Hello, Cinematary. This is Zach, your host, and I'm going to use this midpoint in this week's episode to let you know a little bit about what's happening on both the website and the podcast. So first off, I know for a very long time we asked you not to give us any money. Well, things have changed. We want that money. I'm just kidding. We just want like $5 a month for the rest of your life. But we're doing a Patreon, and I promise this is all in good fun. Patreon.com/cinematary. I'm sure you've heard us mention it at the end of the episode. We are doing this in order to pay for our writing that is happening on the website. We have a wonderful breadth of writers who are all giving a lot of time and effort to come up with reviews and share their thoughts on the website. And so we wanted to just give back to them in that way. And so that is why we created our Patreon page. So again, for $5 a month, you can get exclusive content from the staff. Right now we have our hit series Film Theory and Chill, which takes a piece of film theory each month and then deconstructs it in a way that makes it a little bit more accessible. And then we end that episode usually with just us rambling about whatever is on our mind at that period of time. It's for some people, I guess. but you can find that on patreon.com/cinematary. Please consider, you know, making that donation each month just to help show these writers your appreciation for what they do. Another easy way to kind of keep up with what's happening on Cinematary is signing up for our free newsletter. So if you missed an episode, if you weren't paying attention to social media and you missed maybe a review or something, or a video essay or something that we posted, this is an easy way to keep up with all of that. So each Sunday we send out a note. It goes straight to your inbox. It gives you the latest podcast episodes, you know, what's happening on the Patreon page, and the last two reviews that are on cinematary.com. This is a great way to keep up with what's happening, and it's a nice way if you forget to go, oh, hey, I'm not, you know, just chilling out on a Sunday. I'm having some coffee, doing Sunday things. Here, I'm going to check out what Andrew wrote about something, or what Nathan wrote about something. Just, you know, we got that stuff going. So you can find that on the website, cinematary.com. You can sign up for the newsletter. Again, it's free. And finally, the easiest way to support this show is to go on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and give us a rating and review. You know, this is just how the algorithms work. I know every show asks you to do this, but honestly, if you could take, 30 seconds to a minute and do this, it would greatly, you know, help us. I mean, this helps us just as much as, you know, signing up for the Patreon or letting people know on social media that you listen to Cinematary and you enjoy it. All of that stuff is very helpful. So give us a rating or review on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you listen to the podcast, and, you know, share it on social media. Let people know that Cinematary is around. So again, consider donating to Patreon. That's patreon.com/cinematary. Sign up for the free newsletter and then give us a rating and review on your podcaster app. Well, that is way too much of me talking. You're about to hear more of me talking, so I apologize in advance. But thank you for listening, and let's get back to the show. Episode 342 of Cinematary. In this part, we will be concluding our Tilda Swinton series with 2011's We Need to Talk About Kevin. Directed by Lynn Ramsey, from a script by Ramsey and Rory Stewart Kinnear, and based on the book of the same name by Lionel Shriver, the film stars Tilda Swinton, Ezra Miller, and John C. Reilly. This is such an absurd name. Eva Kachadorian is a travel writer publisher who gives up her beloved freedom and bohemian lifestyle to have a child with her husband, Franklin. Pregnancy does not seem to agree with Eva, but what's worse, when she does give birth to a baby boy named Kevin, she can't seem to bond with him. When Kevin grows from a fussy, demanding toddler into a sociopathic teen, Eva is forced to deal with the aftermath of her son's horrific act. Lionel Shriver was offered a consultant role in the production process, but declined, stating she had, quote, had it up to her eyeballs with that book, though she did not express concern for how the film would capture Eva's role as the unreliable narrator. Tilda Swinton told The Guardian in an interview that the movie triggered memories from her childhood, including where, and guys, just buckle up for this one, including where she saved her younger brother from dying, but actually initially kind of wanted to off him herself. Quote, I was going to kill him because he was a boy, naturally, and I already had two brothers, and that was just too much to bear. She was 4 and a half when she entered the brother's room and said, I hadn't thought it through, but I was willing to wing it, and I noticed he had a ribbon from a baby bonnet sticking from the corner of his mouth. I started to pull it out and then was witnessed in this great act of love of nurture. So I guess her brother was choking and she saved him, but she also wanted to kill him.
Who was four and a half, her or the brother?
Tilda Swinton.
What, how do you think thoughts like that when you're 4 and a half? Like,
listen, we've spent a whole month with her. Do you not? Honestly, that didn't faze me at all. I was like, that seems right.
This is how she became that witch in Narnia.
It didn't really faze me. She continued that monstrousness, she realized, might always be bubbling just beneath a person's surface. Quote, whenever there are children killing children or perpetrating great acts of violence, there's always the word evil pulled out of the top drawer, not even the bottom drawer. It's a very quick response, and I'm always struck by it because from the age of 4 and a half, I have known that it ain't in no drawer. It's at closer hand. Isn't that the triumph of civilization, that we manage not to be monstrous? Guys, we should probably, like, instead of talking about Kevin, we need to talk about Tilda Swinton. Swinton, in an interview with Roger Ebert on the character of Kevin being viewed as evil, she said, I think there is a way in which society tries to push difficult things away from us, and we try and push them away ourselves and say that they are evil. We say that they are foreign. We say that they are not of us. That it is not really useful to society. I'm not saying that one necessarily needs to embrace this darkness, but to know that it is of us, that it comes from us, that is really, really important, because then we can look at responsibility. And then on the notion of whether the movie made her rethink having kids, Swinton said, quote, the movie is a fantasy. It's never going to be that bad. Everybody thinks for one moment when they're pregnant that they're actually carrying the spawn of the devil. But I remember noticing when I had my babies how much I liked them, and not just loved them, but I was really into them. I knew I was going to be curious about them and up for the mayhem ahead. But at the same time,
I didn't even want to kill him.
Yeah, you know, I didn't even want to kill him. You know, I didn't want to kill my babies. You know, that's a big deal. But at the same time, I remember noticing, I was relieved this thing was present in me. I hadn't realized there might be a doubt. I thought it was going to be automatic, and something in me said, no, you're really lucky here. In 2011, the LA Times said, it's a domestic horror story that literally gets to us where we live. A disturbing tale told with uncompromising emotionality and great skill by filmmaker Lynn Ramsey. The New York Times said, Miss Ramsey, with ruthless ingenuity, creates a deeper dread and a more acute feeling of anticipation by allowing us to think we know what is coming and then shocking us with the extent of our ignorance. And Roger Ebert in 2011 said that the film works so brilliantly as a tribute... That the film works so brilliantly is a tribute in large part to the actors. So let's talk about Kevin. Had anybody seen this before the podcast?
Yes. Yeah. I've seen it like 3 or 4 times.
Oh, really? What's your experience with We Need to Talk About Kevin?
I really liked the interview that Tilda Swinton did where she's like, it's not really that bad. Like, I think that as a woman, like, when you watch this movie, you're kind of like, this is like worst case scenario. Like, this is like when your nightmares come to life. Like, when you think about having a kid, nobody wants to think about their kid like being inherently evil, where like the factors around them didn't really influence like how monstrous like they became. They just were born that way and like went out and killed people, and now like you're responsible because you raised them and we're supposed to like teach them how to be a good human being. But I think that Lynn Ramsey like kind of plays around with that idea and with like perspective, because whenever, like, after watching this movie multiple times, like, there are, like, things that you see differently the second and the third time that you watch it, where you're kind of like, well, I thought I knew what this movie was doing, but maybe it's doing something else. At the beginning of the film, like, the timeline jumps around a lot. Like, the way that the movie, like, plays out, it's very, like, fluid, like, time is just running in different directions because it's going back and forth between, like, her in the present, the after, like, everything happens, like, after the incident happens, and then her, like, at the beginning of her life, like, before she has Kevin, and then throughout her pregnancy, and then as he's growing up. And those things kind of, like, play together and go back and forth. And the like way that that works is that you're kind of like with her and like going back and forth between like everything is from her perspective, like the story is played out through her perspective, and there are things that she's seeing where you're like, well, is this really a reliable narrator? And that is kind of like what I love about the movie. I don't think it's like super cut and dry, like, hey, here's like a nightmare scenario. I think it's kind of like, well, if you read it, like, maybe Tilda Swinton's character is misremembering things. Like, maybe she's coping with the fact that her son, like, turned out to be a murderer by seeing things differently. Like, remembering him as being inherently evil when really it was, like, the way that he was raised, like, you know, when she, like, throws him up against a wall and breaks his arm, or when she's, like, being critical of fat people or telling him how to dress. And she's, like, you know, not saying that she's, like, being a bad mother, but, like, all of these factors could have contributed to, like, how he turned out. And so I know, like, a criticism of this movie for a lot of people is, like, why make Kevin, like, inherently evil? Like, why make him this, like, monster? But I think it's for a purpose because it kind of, like, plays with the fact of, like, are we getting the story straight from Eva? Like, is she telling us everything that we need to know about the situation? And so I think that the movie is, like, I don't think the movie is, like, trying to answer any questions about motherhood. I think that it's just showing, like, two sides of the story, if that makes sense.
Well, I think it's kind of showing, like, a exaggerated, for like you said, like an exaggerated version of motherhood. And like Tilda said in the interview, like, this is a fantasy, like, it's not this insane, but it's just, I think it's kind of exaggerating the but maybe like the anxieties, because, you know, I think, again, to like the point that she made in her interview, you know, I'm sure that there's these insecurities, like, will this child like me? You know, and the fact that, and we can get into this a little bit later just about the character of Kevin, but I think that what the movie's really good at is that it kind of, like, to a degree, yes, you know that she's an unreliable narrator and that it's not to the extent that she kind of is viewing it at, but at the same time, it really does capture, like, she's kind of questioning herself, like, is, like, does this kid really hate me this much, or am I just, like, losing my mind to a degree? And I think that it kind of, it really does grapple with that pretty well. Reed, what did you think of the movie?
Yeah, I think that's really fascinating, Jessica, because I didn't necessarily read it that way when watching it, but I think that's more a testament to me not fully thinking about it as I needed to. I think it's more because I did think the movie came off kind of prescriptive, or Kevin's totally evil, or just looked like hell. Like, the movie feels like hell. because of Kevin's character. And I did realize it was a lot of processing, a lot of memory and stuff, but for some reason it really didn't stick with me that the idea of her being such an unreliable narrator, and that we know pretty early on that Kevin's done something horrible. We know pretty early on that it involves kids at the school and that it's likely some like deadly scenario, right? But because of that, I should have read into it and then realized that we're seeing it all through Eva's eyes. She's reassessing all of her memories, all of her experiences with him, and then reading into those even more. So even if they are somewhat true, she's now viewing those experiences and those memories through the eyes of her son being this murderer, which I think is really fascinating and definitely makes the movie like click a lot more for me. Now, because before I was impressed with the craft. I thought Tilda Swinton was great. I don't know if I can ever watch Ezra Miller in a movie again, but
he seems like a relatively detestable person anyway, so that's fine. That's a win. Good.
I didn't know that. Perfect. I won't then. I found it to be impressive on every front, but I didn't necessarily buy into maybe the purpose yet. But then hearing you say all that, it did really click. So I think that's really interesting. Even if I didn't necessarily enjoy watching this movie. And then my surprise that you saying you've seen it 3 times is solely because I really thought this movie was miserable to watch. As impressive as it is, and as much as like I like thinking about it, it is absolutely brutal to get through.
Yeah, I'm definitely on that side too. I struggled with the characterization of Kevin, and that is illuminating hearing that there was like apparently intent to make an unreliable narrator. I guess I didn't really see a point where I would like necessarily doubt Tilda as a narrator. Like that she is like, cause like a lot of this is like so insane. Like if it is like, it's either like extremely delusional or like this kid is like demonic or something. Like he's just so like cartoonishly evil that like, I don't know. Yeah. I guess that was, I'm curious about like what points sort of like make us think that she is like a, not to be trusted.
Yeah, no, you hit the nail on the head, at least for me, which was, and I saw that Michael made this point on his Letterboxd review, but I think the issue, like I like the movie, I think that like just the psychological, like what it's kind of manipulating you in that fashion is effective, but it was almost like Kevin was too pitch perfectly evil, you know. There wasn't, at least for me, there wasn't that moment where I could kind of believe that Tilda was being delusional at any point, because I was like, no, this kid is like everything he's doing, it's the kid, you know. Just be, and that, and it's not the, you know, that's just more the fault of like I think not necessarily the performance, but just kind of the way he's written. Like there really never is this moment where there's kind of this ambiguity of, well, maybe she's just misreading it. It's like, no, he just kind of seems this insanely evil the entire time. And I think that kind of hurts the movie to a degree, because it, you know, you never really are on this ambiguous scale. You're kind of, at least for me, you're kind of always on Tilda's side, and she is an unreliable narrator at the same time. And so I kind of struggled with that. I mean, I don't know. What did you all think about that?
So I think the key to like all of that is the end scene where she's like goes back to the prison, and he, like, whenever she visits with him previously, he's just wearing, like, regular clothes, and his hair is still long, and he kind of looks the way that he did whenever he, like, was first arrested. But at the end, when she visits him, and it's the anniversary of, like the incident or whatever, like his head is shaved and he's wearing a prison jumpsuit and he's like beat up, like obviously was like beaten in prison and stuff like that, and like he didn't look that way like any of the other times that she was visiting him, and so it's almost like she was seeing him for the first time like as he really was. And when she asked him like why he did it, he was like, you know, honestly, like I don't even know anymore, like I thought that I did know but I don't. And so she is like looking for answers. So I think like her thinking back to like him when he was a baby and things that she might have said to him or things that she'd done to him, she's like, she in her head is like coping with the fact that, like, you know, maybe she wants to blame it on him. Like she wants him to just say like, well, he was born evil and so I'm not at fault, like I'm not a bad mother because I did everything I possibly could for this child and he still turned out like bad and that is not my fault. And like I think that the movie kind of like plays into that too, because like Eva is a very sympathetic character, like we are supposed to feel for her because like throughout the entire movie people are like slapping her and like spitting on her, and in the grocery store like everybody is staring at her all the time, and that is like a recurring thing in the movie. And so I think that it's just like her coping with the fact that she's like, well, you know, he had to have just been born evil. There's no way that what I did made him the way that he is.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And then, you know, to your point about the kind of social pariah angle to the movie, it reminded me a lot of the one we talked about in our last series about Mads Mikkelsen, The Hunt, where he would just like go places and you would have like these very tense scenes where he's like at the grocery store and people are just glaring at him. I felt like those, it was on the same wavelength a little bit there. I know there's probably like 50 video essays on YouTube about this, but did anybody have any theories or just any kind of armchair thoughts on the use of the color red in this movie?
It's there a lot.
I couldn't come up with anything, and I figure people have to like figure it out, but I don't know.
Well, like, are you trying to figure out what it means, or like?
I couldn't imagine what red means in this movie. I couldn't imagine.
I mean, I think like when her house is like splattered with paint, with red paint, and she spends basically the rest of the movie slowly chipping away at it, cleaning the windows, like cleaning her house and her car to make it look like it did before. I think maybe that's like just like, I don't know, it sounds almost dumb to say, but like a metaphor, like her life has been stained completely by what Kevin has done at this point, and her life was rather tidy before. Even if her relationships were not good, she had like a life people might envy, like a big house, a family, a good job. But now her life's like completely ruined and not the way she wanted it to be. She lives kind of in this more shack looking house that's older. And now it's been just absolutely splattered with this ugly red paint that she has to work really hard to dig off and meticulously to get off of her house. And I think there's probably a little bit there, like her just like chipping away at it for basically the whole runtime of the movie.
Yeah, but there's also, I mean, you have scenes where it's you know, sometimes inconspicuous, but you'll see there'll be red in the background. You have the scene in the grocery store where she's hiding from the mother of one of the girls who Kevin killed in the massacre at the high school. And like when she turns the corner to hide, you have like that wall of tomato sauce cans behind her. There's just a lot of,
and the less conspicuous ones where like her and traveling and just like bathed in red paint or whatever that is.
Yeah.
In the beginning.
No, that was like tomatoes. That was like a tomato festival.
Oh, okay.
Right. Gotcha. I love that scene. I mean, it's all calling to attention, like, blood and trauma and violence, right?
Yeah, like when she's scrubbing the paint, like she literally has blood on her hands. Like it is her fault, like as the mother of a murderer, like she is always going to be to blame.
Yeah. So, you know, evoking kind of the movie The Hunt again, I think one of the interesting things for that one for me was not only like what it was saying about, you know, the alleged crime involved, you know, in that movie, but also just kind of the kind of village thought around it and how people really turned around on each other and on the Mads Mikkelsen character. So kind of going back to the point of about her being like the social pariah, which does, you know, encompass a lot of the movie, because when you're not like in the flashback, you're generally like following her in her day-to-day life in the present day. And so, I mean, what did you all make of kind of how this movie captures, you know, the aftermath of this, you know, incredibly tragic incident and kind of how she's supposed to live her life after?
Well, I think those are the scenes that I really responded to the most. And I really felt like that was like a movie in itself. Like it would almost, like I imagined a version of this where like we only get flashes of the past and we just stay with Tilda through this, and like we don't even like, I think less could have been more, but like now that I think more about what Jess has said about, I'm very curious to approach the film again, and I almost feel like what we're experiencing is maybe like a, like there was a more accurate version of events that Tilda would have brought to us, like initially, if we had like been touching, like if the film had concentrated on her earlier after the event took place and she was reminiscing then. It's almost as if these memories have like festered in her mind and have grown like more teeth and more exaggerated features, sort of. And maybe that's what the discrepancy sort of is with me in this movie. And maybe that's really what I wasn't seeing, is sort of like, she's sort of corrupting and telling herself stories and sort of like making the past a horror movie that it wasn't, maybe. And that's what sort of, and that is like the kind of, that's the person we're seeing in the present day, is someone who is very anxious, very torn up and like paranoid and going over like little details and things like that. And I guess that does make a little more sense to me now that I think about it. But yeah, those are the sequence, like the opening sequence is incredible. I absolutely love that with the tomato fight wherever she is.
Yeah, I wonder if she's like in Spain or something. But like the thing that's so cool about the opening sequence is it like feels like kind of like what Reed says, like you're in hell or something, because it's like it looks like everyone is covered in blood and like they're all cramped together in the same space, and like it just seems like very chaotic and very unsettling. But then as the camera like finds Tilda Swinton, she's like smiling and like people are lifting her up in the air and she is having a great time. Like she looks like she's having an awesome time. And the movie goes on to kind of like present the idea that she was like a wanderer, a traveler, and her getting pregnant was like perhaps the worst thing that could ever happen to her. So
the opening scene reminded me of the orientation or whatever in Raw, when they throw all the raw meat or whatever on the people. Does anybody?
Oh yeah, yeah.
that's what I thought it was. I was like, oh shit, am I watching Raw again? Because I don't want to be.
Oh yeah.
Whatever. Raw is such a good movie. I do not care.
I thought of like Dead Alive when they've got the lawnmower and they're mowing down zombies in that movie.
Do you think Army Hammer likes
Cotty's Ava?
Oh my gosh, too soon. I don't want to talk about that. This is awful.
We're not gonna address that on this podcast.
It's
not
gonna get political.
This podcast is firmly not about Amazon or Army Hammer.
I kind of knew that Army Hammer was like creepy, low key though. I'm gonna be real.
I mean, he plays it so well.
Was it acting?
I mean, he had a little bit too much fun, you know, in Sorry to Bother You. Like, a little too much fun. Anyway. Now let's get us back. We're really getting lost in tangents in this episode. I don't know what's going on here.
Not as bad as Technolust. That was, like, the tangent episode.
But Technolust is quite honestly a tangent movie, so... So kind of bringing it back to Tilda Swinton, I feel like this is probably, I guess I Am Love to an extent as well, but like this seems to be much more of like a traditional role for her compared to, you know, like what we talked about, like kind of where she, in a movie like Suspiria, where she's playing like four different roles, or, you know, something like in a Wes Anderson movie, or just the kind of variety that she brings. This one seems much more like a traditional acting role. And so, I mean, in terms of just, you know, how she pulls this off and kind of how believable she is in the part. I mean, what did you make of her as this kind of central character to an extent in this movie?
I was just going to say, I think she's good. I think she holds it down because... Honestly, my biggest hesitation to this movie is that it's maybe a little too laser focused, but it's a good thing that it's laser focused on Tilda Swinton. In my mind, I think she does a really excellent job. I do think one of the weird things that bothered me a little bit, which this is probably silly, but I feel like a lot of her as a person in this movie is forecasted through her different haircuts. Even though that's just like a symbol of the time and marking what time period we're in, I feel like it's like, oh, she has a kind of bad haircut now. This is her afterwards. I don't know. That bothered me a bit, but that has nothing to do with her performance. I thought she was good, personally.
Yeah, I honestly feel like she is playing like two different characters in this movie. Like, I think that she is playing... like before the incident and then after the incident. And those are like two pretty different characters to me, at least.
Yeah, it feels like two different movies. And I think that's where like I think this can kind of like either get better for me in repeated viewing or get worse. I'm not sure. But like it is very interesting to me. This like I'm just like constantly trying to figure out what it's doing with these like borderline horror movie like I'm watching Insidious or something, and then like more standard Lynn Ramsey kind of stuff. But I really enjoy in particular like. When Tilda's just on her own, she carries it so wonderfully. Although I have a hard time believing she would ever marry John C. Reilly.
He's such a good
dad.
He
sticks out like a sore thumb. It makes me feel like I'm watching like Tim and Eric's bedtime stories or something the whole time. Especially when he gets killed with a bow and arrow.
Yeah, I brought it up, you know, outside before we started recording, but who kills John C. Reilly? Like, I mean, I don't know. It makes no sense that like why would you kill him? He seems like so like sweet and cuddly. He's so nice the entire movie. He's just like, "Oh, he supports your weird bow and arrow, you know, fascination that you know, clearly was like immediately I knew this was not going to go into a direction that we wanted it to go. Just, you know, out of all the stuff you did, Kevin, that was the lowest. You killed John C. Reilly. he did nothing to you except be a little sweet man, you know. And in the words of Dewey Cox, the wrong kid died. That's all I'll say.
Yeah, well, another thing I'm curious about this movie is I think like one of the like leading jokes with this movie is like it just feels like hashtag never having kids or something, which like I kind of think is kind of like missing the point. I like to think that that's not what like is going on here, because it's really simplistic as far as like a read on this movie. Because like, I mean, sure, like I definitely think there are plenty of reasons that you can find in this really messed up world to not have kids. But this has this whole like weird, I don't know. I really don't think it's trying to say anything like that. I think it's, and I don't think it's necessarily even about like, well, Tilda is definitely like to blame in some regards if we take certain aspects of these like incidents in hand. But I guess I'm a little confused about what it's trying to say about like children and parents and the responsibility there.
Yeah, I don't think that it's anti-motherhood at all. Like, I don't think it's anti-having children or anything like that. Like, I think you can see that with Celie's character, like the little sister, because she is, like, so sweet. Like, she's the opposite of him and is just, like, very kind-hearted and very sweet. And so I feel like if the movie was trying to be like, yeah, all children are evil, then, like, the second sibling, like, probably would have been evil also. But, yeah, like, I don't think that it is, like, anti-children or anything. I do think that specifically the movie is talking about, like, the sacrifices of becoming a mother and how, like, you are growing this, like, child in you and it is now your responsibility. And, like, regardless of what happens, like, society will blame the mother, like, for anything that the child does wrong. Like, that is, like, automatically where the blame goes. And, like, when you're a mom and you're in public with your kid, like, you're constantly being watched with, like, what you're doing and being judged. And, like, there are lots of aspects of motherhood that are nightmarish, and I think that this movie takes those and kind of, like, amplifies them. Like, you're sacrificing your life for this thing that could or could not become a bad person, and, like, you're rolling the dice. But also, like, I don't think that people are born inherently evil. Like, I think a lot of it is, like, the environment that you're in, and, like, as a parent, it's your responsibility to show them empathy and to show them kindness. And I think that this movie is kind of just, like, posing a question or, like, posing ideas, but I don't think that it is, like, saying, oh no, like, all children are evil, or, like, being a mother is the worst thing that could happen to you.
That totally makes sense to me, but I think one of the reasons I struggled was because he does just seem so evil, like, beyond what she's able to control, he seems evil to me. So I think he's evil to the extent that it's a little difficult for me on a first viewing to even see how it's about motherhood broadly or parenthood broadly, as opposed to just being like a very, very hyper-focused character study.
Yeah, I guess the key is sort of like that explains a lot of that does seem to be the fact that these are delusions of Tilda's. Is that sort of, I don't know, am I wrong there?
No, I think that that makes sense, because, like, they're delusions that are, like, delusions that are fears, that are fears coming to life. Like, anxieties, like Zach said before, anxieties of any parent would have. Like, you have anxieties that your kid is going to hate you. You have anxieties that your kid is going to never be potty trained and, like, poop his pants at, like, 8 years old, apparently. Like, you have anxieties that your kid is going to, like, murder a bunch of people and, you know, stuff like that. Like, those are all anxieties that I'm sure people have before they have kids. But, like, potty train your child. Tell them to use the bathroom and also like tell them to love other people and like, you know, I mean, that like that's the part of the movie that is like mildly ridiculous, but again, it is like heightening those fears, which like to me, we need to talk about Kevin is a horror movie to me. And it is a horror movie that is like heightening anxieties, but I don't think that it means, I mean, it's just like any other horror movie that does that. I don't think it's saying like, yeah, being a mom is always going to be awful. Like kind of like Rosemary's Baby. Like, it's, like, the anxieties of being a mom or becoming a mom. But, like, I don't think it's saying, like, never, ever have children.
Just don't have the spawn of Satan.
Yeah, avoid exactly.
Because that means you're Satan.
Just avoid
it. You know? It'd be a bummer. I would be curious, like, because obviously what you think about, like, the whole time is, like, Columbine and a lot of these shootings in America. And I guess like what's interesting is the contrast here, because like what I'm sort of used to, like at least the narrative being, or like what I've read from like from mothers or like people who were friends with like people who did horrible things, is like quite often it seems like the like catchphrase is like, we never saw it coming, or like I just don't understand how it could get to this place. Or like he seemed like a quiet, young, nice boy or something. It's interesting to see in this movie that it's like actually like totally the opposite, where it seems like Tilda has like, oh, I knew it. Totally. I saw it. Nobody else did. It was the whole time. Kind of interesting that it sets it on its head, kind of.
No, that's true. I would agree with that. Any final thoughts on We Need to Talk About Kevin before wrapping up?
I would like to say that the camera work is very good. I love like how there are so many illusions and like optical illusions in this film. Like my favorite is whenever we think that we're just like looking at Tilda Swinton and she like plunges her head in the water and it just like startles the shit out of you where you're like, oh shit, she's like diving her head like face first into the camera, but it's actually like water. I think that is super cool and very creative. So good job, Lynn Ramsey.
Yeah, I do like Lynn for sure, even though I have like mixed feelings about this one. And I would say like to anyone who like is into this but not sure or something, or I know like Reed, you said you weren't like super like sold on it, like I would definitely suggest like seeing more of her movies too if you haven't. Like Morvern Collar I really love, and You Were Never Really Here I really liked. I think that's part of like why maybe this one didn't hit me as hard, because I had like really high expectations after that. But I don't know, I'm interested to revisit.
All right. Well, that will wrap up this episode of Cinematary. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cinematary, on Twitter and Instagram at @cinematary, and on Letterboxd at letterboxd.com/cinematary, where we list all the movies that we talked about in this episode, including Seth's YouTube video movies. So look at that. Oh, yeah. Big time. Check us out also on Patreon, patreon.com/cinematary. Real quickly, thank you to our patrons: Cam, Chad Newsom, Christina Daughtry, Corey Willingham, Harry Eskin, Maggie, Ron Hayes, Titus Arthur, Tyler Chandler, and Whitney Rio Ross. Thank you so much for your patronage. I'm going to toss it over, though, to Jessica, because she's going to be spearheading our new series, as well as a special treat. See what I did? Special treat on the Patreon page. So Jessica, take it away.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, so our next series is, and I'm gonna be real with you guys, the reason why we did this series is because I have had a crazy like work life lately, and I haven't been on the podcast very much besides like this Tilda Swinton series. Like before that, I haven't been on very much, and so the gang was like, we should get Jessica more involved, so let's do a food
That's
series.
That's what happened. I can confirm.
So I I know. It's true. I'm going to be honest with our listeners. Like, life isn't crazy. I started a baking business. Like, I started an Asian bakery. So, of course, like, it's crazy. But anyways, yeah, so our food series. Am I announcing the movies that we're doing? Oh, I didn't know that
I'll pull them up. While you continue to talk about how transparent you are.
Okay, I mean, I feel like I know them out of order. So I know that we're doing Babette's Feast, and we're doing Ratatouille. Of course I had to do Ratatouille, you guys. And Little Forest, and Jiro Dreams of Sushi, right? Did I get it? Yeah, I did it. So those are the four movies that we're doing. I'm extremely excited about it. I love food. I believe that food is powerful. Food is a love language. And I'm super excited to talk about all of these awesome movies and how they capture the beauty of food in cinema. So if you are not a patron already, then you need to become a patron, because like it's $5. It's $5 a month. That's like a cup of coffee that you can sacrifice. And if you are a patron, then you can get this like amazing pork adobo recipe. Like, adobo is a Filipino stew, and I'm going to be doing a pork adobo recipe for all of our patrons, and you're not going to be able to get that unless you're a patron. So you should do that. Also, you can watch us live stream these episodes, and I'm going to be like looking cool. I don't have a chef's hat, which I should get one, but I'm going to be looking cool. And
oh my God. If you have like a little chef's and like a little mustache, like the guy in Ratatouille, like the chef guy in Ratatouille, that'd be great. I take it back. Do that.
I don't. And our patrons don't give us enough money for me to buy one. So you guys should become
a
patron.
How much is a chef's hat?
What? A lot. A good chef's
really?
Hat. Yes.
Hold on. I gotta look that up. I'm gonna look that up right now. Chef's hat.
Like a not like a culinary chef's hat. Like a good.
There's one that says Chef Smith, and it's $15. So shut up.
$15. Three people become patrons to buy chef's hat.
It says Chef Smith.
Instead of paying our writers more money, I'll buy a chef's hat just for
this
these
one's
four movies.
I'm gonna buy you a chef's hat.
Oh my God. Anyways, so yeah, we're live streaming and you can watch us and it's gonna be great. I was gonna say I could eat good food while we're doing it, but then you wouldn't be able to like hear me talk really. So
no, that's fine.
It'd be weird.
I will say no. The live streaming is not necessarily exclusive to just the series. We're going to be doing that from now on. We're going to be doing a live stream of the series. And the way we're going to do it is, and this is another reason why you should join the Patreon if this is something that sounds good to you, is we'll have the episode like while we're doing it. So we're doing it on Thursday night right now. We'll have, whenever we record the episode, like as we're doing now, we'll be live streaming it onto our Patreon. So if you're a patron, you can watch it live instead of, you guess, waiting and listening to it or whatever. And then we'll have a video version of the podcast on our YouTube channel, as well as our Facebook page. And I think we also have a Twitch now, so we'll have it on Twitch as well. So so we'll be live streaming that. So if you're one of those people who likes to listen to podcasts by like putting it on like putting on a YouTube video or something, which I've learned is kind of a thing that people do now. We're gonna be doing that. So check it out. But if you are a patron of Cinematary, you'll get to watch it live as we do it, which that will include all the raw shenanigans and stupidity that we have in between, like when we're trying to, you know, tar down our shenanigans and stupidity in the episode. So
lots of shenanigans. So like and subscribe, everybody.
I've been watching a lot of sitcoms lately, so shenanigans, just that's all sitcoms.
I was like, you know, I was like, who says that? When does anybody ever use that word?
People in sitcoms. All right. Well, that will wrap up this episode. We'll be back with some food movies next week. Until then, thank you for listening.